This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Signature support for our show comes from Jerry Lane Chevrolet and from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And Robin Dow is producing, and today is her birthday. Happy 24, and so much more for Robin Dow. And in studio to begin our show is Louis Wren. The last 17 years, he has been head of the Louisiana AFL-CIO president. Many of us remember the day when Victor Busey ruled the roost. He did so for 42 years. Louis Wren is the second longest, and you got another 25 years to catch Victor Busey. I think you can do it, Louis.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for that, but I don't think I'll be around no 42 years.
The pride of Broadmoor High School. He knows this town well, and back in the day, Louisiana was a Democratic stronghold, and unions were stronger then than they are now, and there's been an outright effort, of course, to squelch unions in this country and in this state. And that effort has been, to some extent, successful. But there's still 125,000 workers in Louisiana, a little more than that, covered by unions. And the biggest state, not surprisingly for unions, is California with 40 million people, 2.757 million people in the Golden State are in unions. But that is a state that is, do the math. Louisiana's 4.8 million. California's 40 million. So it's eight times the size of Louisiana, and it has more union members than we do because it is a liberal stronghold for the most part. So, Louis Wren, let's start there. Union membership is not what it used to be. You can point a lot of fingers. I know you're out there doing your best to sell workers on the benefits of being in a union. But why is there this mantra that unions are bad?
Well, I think there's a well-funded campaign by the business community that, of course, unions put pressure on them to have better working conditions, higher pay. Generally, I find like business doesn't like regulation unless the regulation's in their favor. Part of the problem here, we've lost two big union facilities over the years. We had a GM plant in Shreveport that hired quite a number of people. It was a union facility, and we saw Avondale leave, and Avondale had a huge number of union employees. So it were two big union facilities that we see have shut down for various reasons. I don't think they had anything to do with union or non-union. I think it was just an economic decision by the car company and by the shipbuilders.
Well, for those who say Louisiana just hasn't done a very good job of retaining union members, this is a southern phenomenon, and as bad as it might seem here, it's worse in most other southern states. Louisiana, 5.7% of the workers are belong to some union. South Carolina, it's 2.0%. North Carolina, 3.4%. Arkansas, 4.4%. Texas, 4.7%. And Georgia's right there with us, 5.8, as well as Tennessee, 5.9, Florida, 6.1. So in states that are blue, there are more union members. Is that coincidence, or is that there's some...
They may be blue because there's more union members.
Yeah, and Louis is wearing his blue shirt. So there you go. 877-217-5757 is your number. And if you'd like to send an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Now, I mentioned in the preview that we haven't had a minimum wage hike since June of 2009, in the first year of President Obama's presidency. $7.25. A listener chided me yesterday. I said, that's less than $15,000 a year. Actually, it's $15,080 if you work every day of the year. So there you go. $15,000 if you're working 40 hours a week. That's generally not going to get you too far in this world right now.
You know, I'm amazed. I actually come from a business family. My father was in business, and I watched him as he dealt with the minimum wage. I love to tell him in the legislature when I was young, he paid truck drivers $1.60. That was minimum wage. He had three delivery trucks, and minimum wage went up, and he didn't panic. He just gave him a little more money, and he had three trucks because he needed three trucks, and I've always been amazed that if we raised employees a dollar an hour, it was going to be the end of the business community. I used to call it the Chicken Little. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. You know, if we paid an employee 50 cents more an hour, that's $20 a week. A business is going to go out there out of business because they have to pay an employee $20 a week. They probably got a bad business model.
Well, I remember my first job, which was 47 years ago. I was making $2.20 an hour working on a loading dock, $18 a day. And I felt like I was rich, but I just typed that in. That'd be $23,400 a year. And over time, I'm sure that's at least tripled. Minimum wage has not kept up with inflation, obviously. Well, imagine working in a place for 13 years and not getting a raise. So why is there this aversion to giving workers a fair share of the pie?
I think it's just the part of a business community that wants to fight regulations. One year working with, at that time, Representative Barra, we filed a bill that would require all these riverboats to pay their employees at least $7.25 an hour. That was quite interesting. And one of the legislators told me that we shouldn't be regulating business. I said, that's fine with me. Why don't we truly make it a free market? Quit giving these people a monopoly. Let's take the limit off, and everybody who wants to invest in the state of Louisiana, if they can do the background check, let's have an open market. I ask them if that's the deal. They won't. No, they like the monopoly. They like the regulation of limited competition, but they didn't want anybody to regulate that they should have to pay all their employees $7.25 an hour. They consider a lot of them as tipped employees.
Well, union workers used to go on strike. President Reagan, when he took action against the air traffic controllers, he put it to the strikers, and he had some people cheering him on. But what about how now people are afraid to go on strike? They feel like they have more to lose than to gain by making a complaint about their wages.
Well, I think there's a difference between making a complaint on your wages and a strike. And the truth is, nobody wins in a strike. It's costly to the company. It's costly to the employees. You know, they forego their paycheck. Sometimes it's the only way we can see employees get the attention to get someone to sit down and negotiate in good faith.
And sometimes it's working conditions. I just heard this morning on NPR that there's a company that is requiring workers to, if they have to take a bathroom break, they can't go for more than 6 minutes. I wonder if there's somebody with a stopwatch there making sure they don't exceed 6 minutes.
Well,
probably right at the door.
Those are the kind of people that are going to keep labor unions in business. I've always said if business treated their employees fairly, paid them a fair wage, provided health care, gave them the dignity and respect that they deserve in the workplace, that unions will go out of business, and I don't see them going out of business anytime soon.
All right. Sharon asked a good question about right to work, and that's something that went into effect when Edwin Washington Edwards was governor of Louisiana the first go-around. He was a union guy, but he allowed that to become law, I think, without his signature, and it changed the world. How much did it change the world?
Well, it had its effects. There were a lot of things going on in 1976. Most people don't know this. That wasn't our first go around. Right to work was in the state of Louisiana. It got repealed in 1955. Got revisited in 1976. Of course, we had the Leslie had gotten shot the day after the bill. There were some problems in Lake Charles on some of the jobs, and I think the atmosphere about that was part, you know, things in this world are very seldom on, it's a decision based on one thing. When you talk to people and explain what it does, they're very surprised. You know, I don't think any lawyer would say, I have to represent a group of people, but only the ones that choose to pay me can pay me. Mm-hmm. I don't think the Engineering Society represents engineers who are not members. But by federal law, the unions are required to represent everybody in the bargaining unit. And right to work says that if you choose not to pay your fair share, then you don't have to. But you still get the benefits of all the negotiated things, the health care, the pension, the work rules. It's extremely unfair, but it is what it is.
Listener Tyler asks, how much of an influence was Victor Busey on you?
Mr. Busey had been retired for several years before I went to work for the AFL-CIO. I did have the privilege of knowing him and getting to talk to him, hearing some of the stories. There was a Gordon Flory.
All right, hold tight. We'll be back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. A few more minutes with Louis Wren. For 17 years, he's headed the Louisiana AFL-CIO. 5.7% of the state's workers are in unions. That's a figure that is not high nationally, but as mentioned in among southern states, it actually is higher than most. South Carolina is at 2%, Texas 4.7%. And 125,000 workers in this state are covered by unions. In a story in the Atlanta Constitution, Journal Constitution, a month ago, it says, between October and March, petitions to unionize jumped 57% nationally. So it appears that there are things happening that are spurring interest in unions. What's going on right now that was not going on a few years ago?
Well, I think it's just the need. People are seeing that unions are a mechanism to have a voice in your workplace, that individually may be difficult to have, that just like the business community has found out, there is strength in unity, that a union is a tool for employees that think they're probably not being treated as well as they should be, to come together and have a voice and have better working conditions, fair pay, health care, and retirement benefits.
Carol in Jefferson Terrace. Carol, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, there's two things I remember from the 70s. One being is people coming from all over the country to work here, including New York City. I mean, were able to pay their bills in New York by working here. And I remember the commercial. Texas has got it. Arkansas's got it. Mississippi's got it. Don't you think it's time we got it? Well, now that we got it, can you imagine paying bills in New York City with Louisiana wages? Thank you.
Well, thank you, and good morning. This is something I've had conversations with a lot of folks as far back as Katrina. When I highlighted after Katrina that there were people who expected folks to come from all over the country to help rebuild South Louisiana because they had just seen that in New York after 9/11. And I highlighted to them that everybody who went to New York probably got a pay raise. They were on the highest pay scales. That people weren't going to take a pay cut to come to Louisiana and rebuild our state. Our wages are not competitive with the rest of the country. And that's why you see some of our best tradesmen traveling all over the country. I was with on an airplane. I ran into a guy who was a plumber and pipe fitter, was going on the road. I said, man, don't you miss your family and stuff? He goes, in 6 months, I will make two times the wages I will make and five times the pension benefits. And when I get home, I got 6 months to spend with my wife and my children. We just don't seem to be able to get to that competitive wage rate. Of course, a lot of times we're competing with Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas. But the workforce has become a lot more mobile, and people can go to California or Colorado or New York just as easy as they can go to Arkansas.
All right. 877-217-5757 in our remaining moments with Louis Wren. David in Atlanta. Hello, David.
Good morning, gentlemen. If Jim would let me, I was the chief union steward for the largest containerized steamship company in New Orleans in the 70s and 80s. Never lost a grievance, a work, or an election, or took a penny from the union. And we had the same contract that the home office did in New York. It was the Office of Professional Employees International, and I was very proud of the work I did. But I want to talk about the minimum wage. You know, when Trump cut taxes for large corporations, which bought their shares back and raised dividends for the most part, people contributed the increase in the economy to the tax cuts, when in fact, most states had raised the minimum wage. And I'm sure if a study would be done, that prosperity we had that Trump took credit for wasn't due to the tax cuts. It was due to the minimum wage increases.
Minimum wage increases by state, and we don't have one in Louisiana. And, of course, we're
stagnant. The economy itself is taking care of some of the minimum wage. Unfortunately, it's making those who are working for minimum wage fall further behind. As we see inflation and prices going up, there were some places who are understanding that wages have to go up to compete in today's market.
Right.
One of the restaurants that were opening after COVID, and they asked him, "Oh, you're not having trouble finding employees?" He said, "The only people having trouble finding employees are the people who want to work on the old model. We're in a new economy and a new model. I have to figure a way to pay my employees a fair wage, and then I can get good employees." Like I said, the biggest, saddest part is, I mean, you see McDonald's and Burger King and even the fast food are now paying above the minimum wage.
Right.
But for those people who are left behind in that minimum wage, it buys less now than it did before.
Now, 5.7% means that 94.3% of the state workers are not covered by unions. What about people on those plants down the river? Is the percentage higher there, or are they not union members for the most part?
I would tell you there's an extremely high percentage of the employees that work in the plant themselves are union. Between the it used to be the old oil and chemical workers, the paper workers, the steel workers who have all merged together now. And I can tell you in South Louisiana, there's a huge number of those plants who are under collective bargaining agreements.
Now, John Singleton has sent me this story, and I remember this. In 1985, June 18th, Representative Kevin Riley, he, of course, was the head of Lamar, the late Kevin Riley Sr., said total frustration triggered his comments appearing in the LSU Reveille, quoted him as saying, "Louisiana has a lazy, stupid population. When I'm in this kind of mood, I should stay away from people," Riley said. The lawmaker who chairs the House Appropriations Committee said in an interview, "He's frustrated because we have made no progress whatsoever in coming to grips with Louisiana's problems. I'm getting out, and you can't do any good. It's like hitting your head against a wall." A few minutes later, he carried his frustration to the House floor, claiming he was suffering from occupational burnout. But he apologized for his statement, saying, "I really apologize for having foot-hoof-in-the-mouth disease." Went on to say, as a society, Louisiana is a banana republic. What we ought to do is declare bankruptcy, secede from the union, declare ourselves a banana republic, and file for foreign aid." And he says, "A typical Louisianian's perception of happiness is a pickup truck and two shotguns." Now, those sentiments in 1985 caused Mr. Riley to never win another election. But there is an element of truth there. Of course, this is hyperbole at an extreme level. But quite often, our workers are the ones who are the scapegoats for all the problems in the state. Our workers are really what make this state go, aren't they?
And I would tell Mr. Riley that he needs to look at numerous studies and reports that show Louisiana has one of the most productive workforces in the country, and that from our perspective, our members are welcomed all over the country. We had over 200 carpenters from Baton Rouge working in New Jersey during the boom of those casinos up there, and they wanted all they can get. They were the most productive workers. Numerous comments and compliments from the people around the country about the skill levels and the work ethics of the workers from Louisiana. We take the UA, which is United Association of Plumbers and Pipefitters. They have a code of ethics for their members. Well, and they expect them to sign on about being productive, being on time, being drug-free, working towards the benefit of, you know, only a successful company can have successful employees.
There you go. And one of the most successful companies in this city and in the world is Lamar, and they are known for treating their employees well, and that included Kevin Sr. and, of course, Kevin Jr. and Sean Riley. They've done a remarkable job growing that company into the biggest billboard company in the world, and they didn't do so by mistreating their workers. Mm-hmm. But Kevin was frustrated, and he was a guy who did not hold back, but I remember there were some people who weren't very happy with him in 1985 when he said that.
He wasn't so frustrated. He turned down the job of being head of economic development.
That's right,
state.
Under Mike Foster. He sure did. He did, and he did, according to most, a good job. He knew how. I tell you what, many times people are hired for these jobs, and they've never run a business. Well, he had run a big, big business, and he built it from a little small-town billboard operation into the biggest in the world. So I loved Kevin Riley Sr., and I loved his candor, but sometimes he went too far. Back after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for having this part of your world on many mornings, including this one. If you're listening, I'm hoping that you'll give us a call, 877-217-5757. A few more minutes with Louis Wren, president of the AFL-CIO for 17 years in Louisiana. Trish in Grand Coteau. Trish, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. I'm of a generation that remembers when minimum wage was $1.25. So anyway, just by way of perspective, in my long career in a variety of work situations, I've been a part of a unionization attempt twice, and both sides I was on management. But I have to tell you that both companies went to extreme measures, sadly, to avoid unionization. But the product of that was more fair, more uniform, better, and more humane working conditions. In both cases, the attempts at unionization were because management was doing stupid, unfair, inconsistent stuff and treating employees as automatons and names and numbers.
Your thoughts, Louis?
Well, oftentimes a union campaign is not successful in obtaining a union, but it's beneficial to the employees that mysteriously all of a sudden it's time for them to get a raise or better working conditions or better rules. And in my estimation, those are successes. You talked about the union density in Louisiana was 5.7%. When we go to the legislature, we don't fight for 5.7% of workers. We fight for 100% of workers. Most of the issues around working people, whether they're getting eligible for unemployment or a fair workers' comp, those are all workers. As Gary Forster told me one time, you only represent 10% of the workers. I said, no, Mr. Secretary, I represent 100%. Only 10% pay me for it.
There you go.
but, you know, that there are numerous things. You know, you look at the non-union sector in the building trades. Their wages are based on the success of collective bargaining of the unions. They know they have to pay a competitive wage. Otherwise, they would be faced with a disaster of a union, you know? So there's a lot of things that are not direct results of union activities, but they benefit workers outside the union
as
well.
All right. Last call for Louis Wren, and hopefully we'll have him back soon. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Hi, Mike. You're on.
Hey, good morning. Union worked for me. I dropped out. I mean, I got out of a Struma High, dropped into Pipe Fitters and Plumbers Union, and right into the middle class as an apprentice. But what I call to say is that the man you have on the radio, we couldn't be doing better in this state. We could not find a better man. He's hardworking, and he works more hours than most people do in a week.
All right. I know many others, and not just Mike, speak well of Louis Wren. He's all smiles, as you can imagine. That's the call you like to get.
Well, I know Mike well, and you know, for most people, first of all, thank you, Mike. And you know, Mike has wrote numerous letters to the editor. I think the newspaper loved to have him as a voice. They kind of contradicted a lot of the voices they got, and is extremely talented and factual. I asked him to write a letter one time, and he kept scratching out lines and go, you have to show me where you got that reference. And so he's very much to the point and has been a great spokesman for working people.
Well, and our time is short today. The president kind of messed things up, former president Donald John Trump, with his home being raided. People want to hear about that, and we got Mike Wolff on deck. But next time you're here, I promise we'll talk about some of the many other aspects of life that the AFL-CIO is involved with that you never hear about.
I'd love to. Mike talked about coming out of high school and getting an apprenticeship, and I'd love to talk about the training programs that the unions participate in, as well as some of the community activities that the members of the labor movement or your neighbors and the people you play ball with and sit next to church. And when the need comes, I'm just so proud to see how well they step up and be part of their community and help their neighbors.
All right. Thank you, Lewis Wren. Appreciate you. And before we get to Mike Wolff, Olivia Newton-John, who sang some of the biggest hits of the 70s and 80s, recasting her image, as the New York Times reports today, from a virginal girl next door into a spandex-clad vixen, a transformation reflected in Grease, one of the most popular movie musicals of its era, died yesterday, at her ranch in Southern California. Olivia Newton-John was 73 years old. She had been battling breast cancer off and on since 1992, so she was a brave warrior and gallant lady, big talent. But I recall Robin Dow has pulled up a quote, actually a little more than a quote. Pepe Bruno took the floor. He was one of those irresistible characters in Louisiana politics, like Kevin Riley, Emile Pepe Bruno. They served in the Louisiana House together. When Louisiana was trying to ban lyrics that were provocative, Ted Hike had a bill to do that. Pepe Bruno, a Republican and a libertarian, got up and he said, no way, and this is how he got his colleagues to go along with him rather than Ted Hike, and you'll hear the name, Olivia Newton-John.
Get physical, physical. I want to get physical. I want to get into physical. Let me hear your body talk. Let me hear your body talk. Olivia Newton-John.
All right, that's Emile Pepe Bruno. He won the day, but we will miss Olivia Newton-John, who had a slew of hits, by the way. And she performed in a lot of places you wouldn't expect. Her concert tour was kind of like Elvis Presley's. I remember at Barton Coliseum in Little Rock, which was an old cow barn. And she sang her heart out to an audience that really wasn't all that appreciative, but also dying yesterday, the spellbinding author and historian David McCullough, 1933 to 2022. He died in Boston, 89 years old, won Pulitzer Prizes for two presidential biographies about Harry Truman and John Adams, and he was a guest on this show 5 years ago, and what a voice he had as well. We will miss David McCullough. And a voice that's still going after all these years, the godfather of the Libertarian Party, Mike Wolff. We brought him here today to talk about politics, including libertarians, and we probably get to that a little bit, but this story that has now taken control of the news cycle, former President Donald Trump says the FBI searched his Palm Beach home and broke open a safe, an account that, if accurate, would be a dramatic escalation in various investigations into the 45th American president. The search, according to two people familiar with the investigation, reports the New York Times, appeared to be focusing on material that Donald Trump brought with him to Mar-a-Lago, his private club and residence, after he left the White House. 15 boxes contain many pages of classified documents, according to reports, and Trump delayed returning the boxes of material requested by the National Archives for many months, only doing so when there became a threat of action. So the FBI took action yesterday, and Donald Trump didn't like it. He apparently was not at home when this happened, but Mike Wolff, I don't think anybody would like their home to be invaded, but did Donald Trump ask for this?
Well, certainly. When did they recover those 15 boxes? It was months ago, wasn't it? I'm surprised it's taken so long.
Well, legal wheels grind slowly sometimes. Look at all the years it took for them to go in and snatch Roger Stone, but that they did, and he got a pardon from Donald Trump. There's nobody around, I don't think, right now to pardon Trump, but he's a long way from being charged with a crime. This is an investigation, but you know the process. The FBI just doesn't on a whim say, hey, let's go down to Mar-a-Lago and crack Don Trump's safe open. What happened? What had it had to happen for them to get to that point?
Well, certainly an intense investigation, and it would require approval probably at the highest level, probably from the Attorney General. It's interesting that Christopher Wray was appointed by Trump, the present head of the FBI. But the FBI, you can always think of them as a positive force or a negative force, depending on whose ox is getting gored.
Well, it's interesting that you're right, that Trump got rid of James Comey. And while Comey was on the sidelines, a story that didn't get a whole lot of attention, he got audited. And I mean audited in a huge way. He had to pay thousands and thousands of dollars in legal fees, ultimately got a refund, by the way. But the refund did not cover the legal funds. And the New York Times, in a story, said that Comey was one of 5,000 returns selected in tax year 2017. And to get that kind of an audit, the odds were over 1 million to 1. So it seems somebody ordered that audit of James Comey. And you can surmise who might have done it. But Trump says this is all politics. Does this smack of a political vendetta?
Of course. I was thinking of who'll rid me of this meddlesome priest, that sort of thing. You know, I mean, Trump doesn't have to directly order things like that. People
well, in his case, did the FBI go down there on the orders of Joe Biden?
Oh, I don't believe so. Biden does seem committed to leaving the Justice Department to operate independently.
And Merrick Garland has been criticized for being a wimp. he would be the one who'd have to sign off on this, wouldn't he?
Yes.
The Attorney General of the United States of America?
Yes, I think so.
So what's the next step?
Well, grand juries. And the grand jury is already investigating the January 6th incident. So I think Trump's got a lot to be concerned about. And I think those of us who'd like to see him in jail have much to look forward to.
You would like to see him in jail?
I certainly would. He belongs in jail.
Well, it was 48 years ago today that Dick Nixon left the White House. Should he have gone to jail?
Yes, he should have for what he did, obstruction of justice at that level.
Okay, we'll talk more. 877-217-5757, back after this. 877-217-5757 is your number. For Mike Wolff, the godfather of the Libertarian Party, noted lawyer, and he's followed the travails of Donald Trump. Back in the day when Mike was leaving Baton Rouge to go to Stanford, he was part of a Young Republicans group that was supportive of Richard Milhouse Nixon, the pride of California, who won the election in 1968 over Hubert Horatio Humphrey, the pride of LSU. And in those days, Republicans regularly carried California, as did Nixon. And Mike Wolff helped Dick Nixon carry the Golden State. Now he says he, being Richard Nixon, should have gone to jail for obstruction of justice. Now, Donald Trump, you pick the crime. He is under investigation for any number of crimes. And, of course, even the Stormy Daniels payment. You think that John Edwards almost went to jail, the guy who was the running mate of John Kerry in 2004, former senator from North Carolina, for sins that were far less than Donald Trump with Stormy Daniels. But Trump seems to be truly Teflon Don, and I'm not so sure that the American people are going to like it if a U.S. president ends up going to trial and perhaps going to jail. The optics of that are not good, Mike. What good would that do for our country, even if it would make you feel good and those who hate Trump rejoice? What would that do for the well-being of our country? And of course, it's a very long question. It always causes a reaction. I can only imagine what Republicans would do to a Democratic president the next time around.
Yeah, I was thinking of Gerald Ford's decision to pardon Nixon, and obviously he was considering all those things you mentioned, trying to put the thing to bed and reduce conflict and polarization in the country. That would be the argument to make for not prosecuting him, but the argument to make for prosecuting him would be the man has made a travesty of the legal system in this country and has violated his oath and prostituted the office and just given a horrible example to the whole world. And basically, our institutions depend on trust, and Donald Trump has been taking a hammer to our institutions and basically breaking down the law, the Constitution. Those things are unforgivable.
He probably, unless something changes, is running for re-election. When I say re-election, he's lost the overall vote twice, the only U.S. president to do that other than John Quincy Adams. He takes the risk of losing the overall vote a third time, but winning two elections. Could he somehow eke it out in the Electoral College again?
Yes, he could, of course, and that's why I hope he doesn't run. And it's good to see Republicans challenging him. But this shows you the problem of our two-party system. The idea of automatically picking either the person the Republicans nominate or the one the Democrats nominate is just crazy in 2022. We need more choices, more options, more competition. The laws need to be changed to allow fair ballot access everywhere, not just in Louisiana, for example, where we have pretty good ballot access.
Well, Mike has been the champion of third-party candidates for some time, and he goes back to being a libertarian before libertarian was cool. I remember he held a lavish convention at what is now the Crown Plaza in 1998. Libertarians from all over the planet came to Baton Rouge. But Donald Trump, and a listener, this is a guy who says he's a Republican, says he's for Ron DeSantis, but if DeSantis were to get the nomination, with Trump being a guy who just can't admit defeat when it is obvious, I suspect he would jump in as a third-party candidate. What would happen then?
Well, that'll be interesting. Of course, we all remember what happened in 92 with Ross Perot, and in 2000, of course, they debate the impact of the third-party candidates in the 2000 race. But the more candidates, the better. Serious candidates. We really need more competition. We can't just turn over all of our law to the Democrats and the Republicans, and that's what we've been doing.
Well, if Trump ran as a third-party candidate, unlike Perot, who split votes from each side, he would presumably take more votes from the Republican and might engineer a victory for any Democrat.
Indeed, yes.
Any Democrat, yes. So... Yes. The Republican Party does have a Trump challenge. He is popular, and of course, in Louisiana, you're not going to have anybody in our congressional delegation take on Donald Trump. They're fearful of him.
It seems so, but of course, that
except
leaves...
Except Troy Carter, of course.
Well, yeah, and it leaves the voters...
And Bill Cassidy.
With the congressional races. And of course, we've got Senator Kennedy in there, and with a couple of good Democratic opponents, particularly Luke Mixon, and we've got a Libertarian in that race. Dr. Aaron Sigler is running in that race, and of course we've got Libertarian candidates in the 1st District, the 3rd, and the 6th. Rufus Craig here in Baton Rouge is running against Garrett Graves. Howard Kearney is running in the 1st District mm-hmm. against Steve Scalise, and Guy McClendon over in Lake Charles is running against Higgs over there.
Rufus ran against Garrett Graves in 2014, and I remember he supported Edwin Edwards in the runoff because he said Edwards had pardoned him.
Yeah, for a peccadillo years ago. But Rufus is a good articulator.
He is a good candidate. Hopefully we'll have him on the show. And, of course, Congressman Graves is invited as well. 877-217-5757, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Yeah, it's just crazy. I mean, this is treason. This political party is committing treason. And the people who vote to say that our president isn't the real president, or that they're not going to honor votes or count votes, obstruction of justice, I mean, they should all go to jail.
All right. Well, they're not all going to jail. And they're political animals. My friend Lester Duay said the first rule of politics is to get elected, and he's right. And you can't get elected as a Republican in Louisiana right now if you're not kissing the backside of one Donald John Trump. So these people are doing it for survival. I don't know how many of them really believe it, Mike. Clay Higgins probably does, but the others, don't you think they're just playing the game?
It could well be that the Republicans are very good at that. Yes, very good at being two-faced, saying one thing and to one.
And you speak as a guy who was a young Republican.
I was, yes.
And libertarians on a myriad of issues often side with Republicans.
I was a Goldwater Republican, and I did admire Richard Nixon for various things back in the 60s.
Well, Nixon, by today's standards, my goodness, he would come across as a liberal.
Sure. He opened the door to China, created the Environmental Protection Agency, did a number of things that are considered highly progressive historically.
Wage and price controls.
That's what created the Libertarian Party, by the way, when he did that. He fell off the wagon there.
But that's not a Republican mantra. And Gerald Ford was his vice president who became the president. Ford said in his 2 years in office, his greatest accomplishment was putting John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court. Well, John Paul Stevens was a liberal. He was pro-choice. In 1973, well, that was before Stevens. But Stevens ultimately was pro-choice, and he also voted to have Al Gore's recount continue in Florida, along with David Souter. Think at that time, Mike, there were seven Republican-appointed Supreme Court justices, and five of them voted for Bush and four for Gore, but Gore had to pick off two Republicans just to get to the four. Republicans have always, maybe by luck or by design, have controlled the Supreme Court in modern time.
Yes, it is really ironic, and especially when now they speak of their religion, you know, and the majority of them are Catholics.
Well, that's right. And of course, one of the Catholics on the court is Sotomayor, who's a liberal. So and Roberts is a Catholic, and now he's coming across as a moderate, but he's really a conservative. But then you got Kavanaugh. And Thomas, and Alito, and Coney Barrett, and those four are really, really, really right-wing evangelical Catholics who are going to vote in large part based on their religious beliefs.
Well, we'll see. It seems so. But
six of the nine justices are Roman Catholics.
It's just amazing to see the influence of religion on judicial decisions and political decisions today. I think the founding fathers would be turning in their graves to see what's going on.
Now, another story, and a listener asked about this, and it is relevant. Alex Jones, who many years ago he was on our program, but he's come across as a nutbag, but he's not crazy. He's crazy like a fox, and he said untrue statements, and probably knew they were untrue about Sandy Hook and this being a fraud, and it was designed to, in his statements, to help gun regulation in this country. And now he's been ordered to pay $40 million. What does this do as far as New York Times versus Sullivan? Does this change the world now, where if somebody is slandered, as these people were, who were the parents of these kids who were slaughtered, do they have an option now they did not have before?
I don't think it's going to change the rule of New York Times versus Sullivan, which basically gives great rein to publishers and writers and so forth in commenting on public affairs. I don't think that will be narrowed substantially. They'll still have a plaintiff will have to show intentional.
And another listener asked this mayor in Shreveport. He's going to the state Supreme Court now. He's been thrown off the ballot, Adrian Perkins, because he used the wrong address.
Yes, and there's a Libertarian candidate in that race, Lauren Anderson. So if they can't vote for Adrian Perkins, they can vote for Lauren Anderson.
But in this case, it's not like the guy's not living in the city. He just has two different addresses, and he used the wrong one, one he didn't have the homestead exemption. Yeah. And they're doing their best to keep him off the ballot.
Yeah, and it looks like they're succeeding. One more court
right
to go,
now,
though.
One more court to go. And Mike, good to have you back from abroad, and we'll be talking again soon.
All right, thanks, Jim.
Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. For Rob and Dow, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Have a great day. Stay safe and stay tuned.